Hello, Represent listeners. This is Aisha, your host, and I'm just checking in with you all to make sure that if you haven't already, you get your tickets for our very first live show that is happening this Monday, April 24th, as part of the Tribeca Film Festival. It's happening at the SVA Theater in Manhattan, and we're really excited to have on Francesca Ramsey, who is the star of MTV's Decoded, as well as the star of many other very fun YouTube videos. You should definitely check her out, and she'll be at the show. So you can get your tickets at slate.com/live. If you are a Slate Plus member, you'll get a 25% off, and hopefully we'll see you on Monday.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Oh, shit. Oh. Yeah. Assalamu alaikum, auntie.
Walaikum assalam. Did you just wake up? It's already 11. I thought there was no way she's still sleeping at this hour.
I'm not sleeping.
Hey, you forgot to say Eid Mubarak.
Eid Mubarak, auntie.
Hey, hey, this is Represent, and I'm your host, Aisha Harris. That clip you just heard is from a web series I unexpectedly found myself binge-watching in its entirety one evening. Brown Girls, created by Fatima Askar and directed by Sam Bailey. If you haven't heard or caught up with Brown Girls yet, you are in for a treat. Fatima and Sam recently stopped by our studios in Brooklyn, and we had a really great conversation about everything from inclusive hiring practices to the Chicago art scene. But first, we return with another installment of one of our favorite segments, Pre-Woke Watching. As you may recall, a few weeks back, we had the amazingly talented Dylan Marin on to discuss his work as an actor and activist. Following that interview, he shared with us his pick for the show that he both enjoys, but also occasionally finds disappointing, a show I'm sure many of our listeners are already familiar with. What is your pre-woke watching, or what is one of your pre, because I'm sure we all have,
I think,
many.
Everything that we want.
I know.
When we were kids. So you mean pre-woke before I became woke, or?
Yeah. So before, like, you really loved it, and but you didn't realize when you first encountered it, whenever it was, whether it was a year ago or when you were a kid, but now you realize, oh, this is kind of fucked up.
Yeah, well, so many things. I mean, like, everything.
Yeah.
But
What's one that just, like, sticks out?
Oh,
in your mind?
I have it. I shouldn't have even said a lot of things. I should have just gone for it. Will and Grace.
I was going to add, that was actually going to be one of my questions for this interview we had. Because I know you tweeted the other day.
Yeah.
You said, I will only accept the Will and Grace reboot if it's about Karen's maid Rosario, immigration, and how the crew will stand with her. And so this was after the, like, right after the immigration ban that Trump put down.
Yeah.
So when did you first encounter Will and Grace, and when did you realize?
Yeah, I first encountered Will and Grace when I was a kid, and I was far from out. I was, like, deeply in the closet, so snug that I didn't even know I was in a closet. I mean, I knew I was gay, but I was like, I'll be staying here, you know, it's comfortable. And I loved it. You saw gay, and I'm using the word gay, not queer. You saw gay men, cis gay men, normalized. You saw them in on the joke. You saw them delivering the punchlines.
Well, what do you think? Too gay?
Yeah, definitely.
But the shirt's good. Hold on, I got a cramp from not laughing.
You saw nuance. Very, you know, only dualism. You know, you only see, like, there is, you could be Jack or you could be Will.
Yeah.
So it's not a real spectrum here, but there is at least two. And I thought Jack was so funny. I thought the plots were so funny. I loved Will and Grace's relationship. Karen, of course, is funny. And, you know, the truth is, I stopped watching it probably in the middle of high school just because, you know, all right, great, I've seen it, and now I'm going to move on. And then I really did not watch any reruns until they came out with that special election episode.
Oh, so this was, like, November, a few months ago.
I mean, this is, like, of course, in my mind, I was always pretty aware that Will and Grace was very white, right? Like, Will and Grace was very white, and Rosario, the maid, Karen's maid, was the butt of jokes. She was really never in on the joke. She might have delivered a zinger. But structurally, if she gets two or three lines per episode, even if they're punchlines, she's not in on the joke. Like, the story is, she's not the star of the story. We're seeing Rosario essentially through Karen's eyes. She's also always in a maid's outfit, which is telling. And sure, that's a funny gag, but there's no other Latina women. There are no other women of color that you can compare her to.
No.
Well, there's one exception. They had a big guest on, and it's Jennifer Lopez. But that's a superstar who is a brand that the audience already knows.
Right.
And when I saw this election special, I was just like, oh my God, Will and Grace is an amazing representation of how unwoke gay people can be, you know, and how, like, babe, you're not woke if you're opposed to Trump. Like, being opposed to Trump itself does not make you a woke person.
No, that's just common sense.
Yeah, right. And yeah. It's just like, guys, there is an episode around the fact, it built around the idea, the thesis of this episode was Will and Grace cast members in character talk about Donald Trump. But it's like, you got to go deeper. You got to, like, how are you implicit in this? You know, how many times did you uphold this notion that, like, well, everything's okay if you're gay and you're just like a beefy white guy, you know? Of course it is. Which is not to downplay the hardships that those men face as well. Yeah, Will and Grace, it was this incredible first step. And now that I hear that there's a reboot coming out, I hope that they've built a staircase on that first step. But judging from the election special, it looks like it is in fact very much that just that first step that they extended into a whole platform.
Yeah. And Karen is now a Trump, like, apparently she's a Trump supporter.
Her Karen was always a Trump supporter, yeah.
Yeah.
But but that's great. That is, in fact, wonderful if they're going to explore the nuance of that. And also, to be fair, humanize her.
Yeah.
Because Trump supporters are humans. And I think so many Trump supporters are inherently good people who... I don't know. Now I'm saying that out loud. I don't know. I just mean to say.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you see all the tweets now. Like, one person I saw tweeted, you know, I voted for you, Trump, but now my wife, who's a green card holder, you know, is crying.
Yeah.
Well, I just wish it didn't take that.
Right.
You know, yeah. there are so many other things that, like, should have.
Yeah. I don't want to be too dreamy. It's just that I definitely do not want to peddle some hopey logic. But I do want to believe that people are inherently good and that they are led to believe certain things. I want to know more about people who don't think like I do. Is Karen the in for that? Like, I don't know.
I agree. Like, it makes logical sense that Karen would be a Trump supporter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, obviously, we do need to see that representation on screen. But then whose hands is it going to be in? And the question is, like, have the co-creators... Like, to me, it's like trying to bring back Sex and the City with the same group of people.
Mm.
And, like, what has... When you go back and watch that show...
That's a really another great one that I'd be like, oh, that's pre-woke.
Right.
Like, it's four... rich white women.
Yeah. And there's so many.
Yeah.
I mean, we could have a whole entire episode about all the things that are wrong with that
show.
You
ask that question again and I'll,
Yeah. But I mean, that's the thing is, like, if you came back with the same creators of this, like, the whole team comes back together 10 years after it went off the air, what have they learned?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question. Like,
right.
Because when the shows went off the air, when Will and Grace went off the air, this was before we had lots of think pieces about stuff happening.
Anything.
Yeah. So, you know, they weren't being called down at it then. Mm-hmm. And will they respond to that now? Yeah.
And I wonder if those platforms were around then, if they would have evolved, you know?
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
All cross fingers.
Yeah.
For the past.
Yeah. Well, thank you again, Dylan.
Please, thanks for having me. It was a true pleasure.
So, Brown Girls made its debut online earlier this year, and as I've already mentioned, I'm a big fan. The series is set in Chicago and features a cast made up entirely of people of color. Nabila Hussein plays Layla, a queer South Asian American writer, while Sonia Dennis plays Patricia, a Black American musician. And the two friends struggle with many of the familiar millennial trappings, you know, relationships, family, careers. What makes this show stand out, aside from its inclusiveness, is its smart sense of humor and just how realistic the character interactions feel. Back in early March, writer Fatima Askar, director Sam Bailey, and I talked about the origins of Brown Girls, how they feel about comparisons to HBO's Girls, and the creative processes on set. Check it out. So, ladies, it's a pleasure to have you both here in our Brooklyn studios. Welcome, Sam and Fatima.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We're super excited.
Yeah, like I was just telling you a moment ago, I love the show. Mm-hmm. I was going to like check it out. I was like, oh, I'll watch like one or two, you know, episodes. And then I wound up watching the whole thing right in a row. So, yes, I'm a huge fan and I'm excited to talk to you. So my first question would be, what is the origin of Brown Girls?
Yeah, so Brown Girls, I started writing Brown Girls in fall of 2015. And it's loosely based off of my friendship with my best friend, Jamila Woods, who then also serves as the music consultant for the show.
Jamila.
Yeah. She's...
I don't know her, but
oh, she's
I love her.
She's great. She's lovely.
Yeah.
But basically, we have at this point, 10-year friendship. And our friendship is just really, really important to me. And I think is like one of the major things that has kind of been it's just been really fundamental in who I am and in terms of like thinking about myself and understanding myself in the world. And I feel like I rarely get to see women of color friendships on TV, and I rarely get to see them between women of color of different racial backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And I think also like even times that I do see friendships, sometimes they're not like they can feel like selfish friendships, or they don't feel like all the time like these like really like the friendships that I feel like I know or is like really how my community operates. So I wanted to create a show that was about these two women navigating, you know, their like mid-20s and thinking about like financial independence and thinking about what it means to be an artist, mm-hmm. and what it means to have like their relationship with their families and stuff like that as they're trying to create. And then also to think about this kind of like larger community in Chicago and this community of creatives of color and of queer people of color, and just wanting to kind of showcase that. So that's kind of really where Brown Girls started.
Mm. And Sam, how did you get involved? Because you directed the series. So how did this collaboration get started?
Well, I've known Fatih for a minute now. We both met like as writers and like a lot in the live lit scene. Obviously, her medium is more like poetry, but I was doing a lot of nonfiction storytelling. And I had done another web series called You're So Talented. And while we were filming the second season, Fatih reached out to me saying she had an idea for a web series. Can she like shadow on set? So I was like, of course. And then a couple months later, she was like, hey, I wrote this series and we're going to do like a reading of it. I would love for you to be there. I was like, great, because I love her work. Mm-hmm. And then we went there and like within the first page, I was sitting next to Amar from Open TV. And I wrote like in the margins, I was like, I have to direct this now. and so after it was done, I kind of like beelined over to her and I was like, look, I think this is like ready to go into pre-production now. And I'd be like really like, I'd be very honored if you let me direct and produce this. And she did. And so we kind of hit the ground running from there. And that was like February of 2016.
Yeah. And secretly, I had been hoping that Sam would jump on in some capacity. Mm-hmm. So I was really, really excited that she wanted to do it. And I think, yeah, like our collaboration has felt really great and felt just like we're on the same vision a lot and the same kind of page in terms of what we hope for the show and what we like hope for the aesthetic of what was happening. And so it just felt like really great to be working together.
Can you talk a little bit about how you pitched the show? And, you know, you're on Open TV, which is a great platform that is specifically meant to amplify voices of people of color, women, trans, LGBT. Mm-hmm. So how was that like central to getting Brown Girls made? Like, how important was that?
I don't think we didn't even need to pitch it, right? Yeah. I think Amar and I already had a working relationship because that's where You're So Talented premiered, was on Open TV. And I think, like, him and I are, I feel like we have very similar ideas of, like, the content that we want to put on. And so, like, we were writing notes to each other back and forth throughout the reading of it. So, like, I think just him, when Fatih invited him to the reading, was in and of itself a pitch. Like, him just hearing it out loud was a pitch.
And for our listeners, who is he in relation to Open TV?
Amar is the creative director. He's the founder of Open TV. Right. And he's been really just, like, kind of amazing in terms of navigating the web series world. Mm. He saw the trailer of You're So Talented, like, the first trailer of You're So Talented, and reached out to me and was like, hey, I'm starting this new thing. I think, you know, You're So Talented could be there. And he really helped us out with, like, post-production funds in that sense. And that was, like, the first filmmaking thing I ever did.
So the show centers around two brown girls, Patricia and
Layla.
Layla. Patricia and Layla. I'm really terrible with character
names. That's totally legit.
And one of the things I found fascinating about the show as a whole is that, you know, whenever a person of color is writing, doing something creative, you always have that pressure to, like, it has to be something about being a person of color, or it has to be about, like, your sexuality if you're queer or whatever. And this show, like, first of all, I don't think there's a single major white character in the show.
No. There's no white people front of the screen whatsoever at any point.
I know. And I kind of I was like, wow, this is great. Because, like, usually, even if it's not a show that is explicitly about that, if you think of something like Insecure, you know, it's still very much about the relationship between those two black female friends. But, you know, Issa Rae's character still has to go to work and interact with white people. And this show doesn't really deal with the proximities of whiteness at all. So can you talk a bit about that? And, like, how does that reflect your personal world?
I mean, I think for me, I wrote that into the script and I, like, made it a point to write it in. And I think it was just, I'm really interested in, like, the relationship between different communities of color and different people of color, right? And I think that so often when you introduce, like, whiteness into a story, it becomes about the relationship between, like, whiteness and whatever the otherness is, right? And I think there's a lot there, and that's really smart, and I'm really interested in that. And then for this project, I was like, I want this to be a thing that is about people of color, that centers women of color, that centers queer folks of color, and like you said, isn't necessarily always about their race or about their sexuality, but where it's just, like, the norm and it's the backdrop. And so I wrote that in, like, I wrote that none of the major characters were to be played by anybody who was white. And then Sam, when we had our first meeting, was like, let's take that further. Let's have no extras that are white. Let's have everybody who's in front of the camera be a person of color. And I was like, great. Like, that sounds awesome, you know? And we had, I think it was really interesting because, you know, people have been like, oh, is that what it, like, how does that play out or whatever? And really, it was like so many of our white friends were so excited about that element of the show, you know? And I think sometimes what we see on TV is, like, it's not only a disservice to people of color and communities of color, it's, like, a disservice to, like, also white people who are like, where are all my friends? Like, right, where are all these people? And so I think it was just kind of an interesting experiment in that sense.
Yeah. And I forgot that we did that, actually. I mean, I knew the main group, but I forgot that, like, the entire world, even the music, is all women of color.
Yeah.
And I think, like, that was an initial thought that, like, we probably made that decision around, like, March or something like that. And then it just became the norm, right? It just became the default. So I forgot about it until people started bringing it up once the trailer and the series came out. And I was like, oh, yeah, that was deliberate. But it was because I think we really wanted to explore, like, what happens when the default is not the white lens, it's not the white gaze. What happens when the default is just, like, all brown people and we don't comment on it. It's just the world that we live in. And it is so much of the world that we live in, you know? And I feel like in a lot of other series, when people of color are in it, then you have to talk about it. Like, oh, this is like this is a teachable moment, right? And we didn't want that. We wanted these characters' spaces to give them space to be flawed and be nuanced and have highs and have lows and all that stuff that I think white characters get to explore in their, like, various storylines. But brown people just are just, like, I feel like they're just tools to get a white person somewhere else, you know?
Yeah.
And then for brown girls, like that, it was them. It was only them. And anytime we were going to explore a part of their storyline, it was just able to come from their lens and their experiences. And that to me was like really refreshing and exciting to work on.
Yeah. So a lot of white filmmakers and people within the industry, they like to say that it's... Sorry, I had to pause for a moment there. They like to say that it's really hard to find people of color, qualified people of color. How hard was it for you to find?
My cup runneth over, right? Like, I was like, we got to a point where we're like, I love you, but we don't have enough roles to, like, put these people on. And that's in front of the camera and behind the camera, right? Like, a lot of our crew were women and or women of color and or queer people of color or like just all of these people that I feel like rarely get to be put on and or at least get to tell their stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so like we had more people than we had roles to fill, mm-hmm. really. And I think it just came from like asking people, like literally just asking people. And everyone on that set was qualified to be on that set, whether they were behind the camera or in front of the camera. Some of them were like more than qualified and a lot of them got paid less than their daily rate that they're used to to doing. But they did it because I think there's the story, they saw themselves in it. And so often, what I kept hearing from the crew was like, oh man, like usually I'm the only one of me on set. Mm-hmm. So to be able to come to set and see a bunch of people that, you know, shared similar experiences and there's like so many like different intersections of experiences there, everyone's just like that much more invested in it because of that. Like all of that just came from being open to utilizing our community.
Yeah.
And if you're not open to that, then of course it's going to be hard to find people. And I think it's really, really, really easy to get a crew of just a bunch of white guys on set and just be like, oh, well, this is all we could find. It's like, well, yeah, because they all went to film school together and they're all like,
right,
you know, I was going to say something bad.
No, but I think that's totally honest. Like, because it's this thing about like, you can't have like a diverse room if you don't have diverse friends. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you can't have like I don't know anything that has that if you don't have people who are of marginalized backgrounds in not just like working on it, but like in roles where they have creative control over things, mm-hmm. right? Or where you're creating an environment in which people feel like they have creative control over whatever they do. And I think that, you know, like Sam said, we just had so many people who were interested and we had people who were absolute masters at the thing that they did.
Yeah.
And like we're able, you know, we had a very small, tight budget and we were able to make a really quality product. And I think that really speaks to the crew who worked on it, right? And it speaks to their level of kind of like expertise and what they did. So yeah, I think that's like the worst excuse that, and I hear it all the time and it's just a terrible excuse.
And mostly it's because, like you said, like it's like, you know, so much of filmmaking is just bringing your friends on, like who's going to, oh, can I get my friend who's going to do sound or whatever? And because a lot of these guys, you know, because like I feel like white people bring up their people all the time, whether or not they're qualified, which then allows them to become qualified, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So like it's so important that we do the same, and like that's like who I'm trying to like fuck with is that I'm trying to bring up like the same people that like look like me or look like, you know, are coming from marginalized communities, because that's the only way we're gonna keep making work.
Well, what do you know? It's that easy. I mean, you talked a little bit about that. You mentioned film school, like they all went to film school together. I mean, neither of you went to film school, right? So I imagine there are so many people of color who like feel as though the doors are not open for them if they didn't, like that's like the only way to get through.
Yeah.
I mean, how has that affected like the way you perceive your own work? Like, have you felt as though, like, have you had to overcome the fear that like you're not good enough to be working behind the camera?
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. I think like filmmaking is super daunting. I think there's just in the idea of like equipment and technical aspects, if you don't have that background, it's a very scary medium to go into. And I didn't have, not only did I not have anyone, did I not go to film school, but I also didn't have anyone to like look to and be like, oh, this is a like a woman of color who's directing, this is a woman of color who's producing her own work. It wasn't until like web series came out that you saw that platform being utilized by people of color,
right?
Specifically Awkward Black Girls, specifically I Can't Saltfish, like all that stuff was coming up at the same time. And I was like, oh wow, I can create something and put it out there like straight to the audience. And I was telling like Fatih, like there's nothing different from web series, there's nothing different in the process of creating a web series or in a short film, except that we get to, there's like no middleman. Mm-hmm. You know, we still, like, the still we still attack that as a film. Like, it's like a film. We shoot it like a film. We shoot it all together like that. And I think just being able to see other other women and women of color making and producing their own work that way totally demystified the process, right? Mm-hmm. And I always like credit this guy who was the cinematographer in both seasons of You're So Talented. His name's Mateo Gonzalez, and he was like really great in teaching me the technical aspects and telling me that like as long as the person, the collaborator you're with that you trust, knows that stuff, it's just your vision. That's all art. You're an artist. You can figure that stuff out as you go. Just make sure your collaborators are people that you trust. Mm-hmm. You don't need to know everything, right? But you need to be able to employ people that kind of know the stuff that you are a little bit like faltering on, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to talk about two scenes from the show that really stuck out to me. The first is the scene, I think it's in episode 2 or 3, when Layla is having dinner with her sister.
Mm-hmm. I have something to tell you.
Okay. Layla? Come on, you're worrying me. Are you pregnant?
What? God, good God, no!
Okay, well, just tell me and we'll figure it out, okay?
Okay. I've been sleeping with women. I'm queer.
And?
What made you want to include that sort of coming out scene? Because we've seen it before, although I can't recall ever seeing it with a South Asian woman before on screen.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was wanting that because she was South Asian, because she's Muslim, you know, and being like thinking about the ways in that I think a lot of times those communities are talked about as like really conservative and just like, oh, like even though kind of national rhetoric about like Muslim people is like, you know, well, we have to save them from their backward selves. And it's like, okay, like, all right, whatever. So I think that there's this kind of there was that element of it. And it was also this homage of really wanting to create a show that was based in love and like wanting to show these relationships that had a lot of love to them, even when they were mean to each other or even when like they're like messing up and like struggling.
Yeah, her roti was not doing too well.
No.
Our set designer trying to make that was very funny. I researched this all night.
thinking about the way that that I wanted to kind of build that love in, right? And I like so often, because I think what's cool about art is you get to invent the things you want, right? Mm-hmm. And so like you it's like I want that answer to always be and, right? Like anybody who's like, I want this, I want that answer to always be and I want that to be the narrative of like that. And so I can make that, right? Like I can make that the narrative of this. And like, you know, just and I think that that is a really cool power to be like, oh, this is the way that this is like normally talked about. And now this is going to be the way that we talk about it here, you know. And like that's not to, you know, her sister says like and then they have to deal with also the fact that like there's this conservative aunt, you know, and like what's going to happen there, you know. And so it's not all like dandy and roses and fine, but like it is like her sister's like, I'm here and like we are here for each other. And so I think that that was just really important to me.
Yeah. And I think also like people, what was so cool about that scene is like I think people would see Musarat as like the perfect like Pakistani daughter. Like she was married to a Muslim man. She was all that stuff was like, you know, we were expecting her to have a different response than what she did. So to see someone that maybe does have like more conservative views still ride for her sister is, I think, really, it's just more nuanced. And you don't see that, like literally the only other scene I could think of where show people of like color and like and talking about queerness in a way that was like positive like that was in Moonlight when the boy asked like what that is. And he's like, it's this. And it's like very, and you don't know what that moment's going to be. And then you don't expect that man to have that response. And he does. And I've never seen it happen again like that except for Brown Girls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one line that stuck out to me is when her sister says, you know, all that hiding is going to kill you. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, oof. Mm-hmm. Like, she says it in a way that, like, you know, when you say like this is killing me in a figurative way, but like in real life, like it does, it
it does kill people.
It does. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So I just thought that was a very, it hit me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that it's true. And I think about, like you said, like, it does kill people. It does. Mm-hmm. What would it look like if we were actually allowed to be our free, full selves all the time? Like, that's hard. That's, yeah, like, it's even hard to, like, allow yourself to be your free, full self when you're by yourself, right? And I think, like, I want a world where we can be that. And I want to create art that brings us closer to that world.
Yeah.
Yeah. On set that day, after we did, like, the first take of that scene, like, I called cut, and everyone, there was, like, I think you were on set that day. Yeah. It was just, like, there was, like, a quiet on set, and I think specifically for, like, Hannah Welliver, who was our DP, and she's a queer woman, and the set designer, she's a queer woman, and, like, a lot of people that they were like, oh, wow, like, that's either a moment that I've had or a moment that I really wished I had. And mm-hmm. that was, like, it was a very, I think we did that scene, like, we just did two takes of that, yeah, and it was, like, it was golden.
Mm-hmm. That was great.
Yeah.
The second scene I wanted to sort of parse through is the one with Patricia and her mother.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's, like, a different form of, like, the love that you're, yeah, trying to portray.
Things aren't going well.
What?
We haven't spoken since we went to Auntie Christie's house for Jaden's baby shower. Remember that fight we got into?
Yeah, but that was months ago.
I know.
Why didn't you tell me?
It's just not really a big deal. Anyways, I knew you were busy with singing, and I just didn't want to take up time.
Mom, I always have time. I'm sorry. I wish I had known.
It's okay.
You know, her mother is just very sort of matter-of-fact, like, your father and I, you know, we're still together, but we don't really, like, feel any, like, the, yeah, love isn't, mm-hmm, really there anymore. Can you just talk a little bit about why you wanted to portray that sort of relationship and, like, how that affects Patricia?
Yeah. Well, I think that there's so many times that we don't think about adults as real people, right? Especially if you're making, like, art around or for people who are millennials or in our generation. And I think that there's these moments in which I think, like, Patricia and her mother, Carla, are actually, like, going through very similar things, right? And they just don't know how to – or Patricia can't see it because Patricia is, like, really, like, here, you know, and in her world, yeah, and doesn't really understand that, like, this other stuff is happening. But, like, that kind of thing about just being wanting to show her mom as a full human being and also wanting to show the way – like you said, the way that it affects Patricia because, you know, she's, like, navigating her world, but in the back of her head, she's just always thinking about her parents and her family, right, and, like, what's happening. And I think that's something that we all feel, right, when there's, like, even, a small amount of, like, change in family, like, that can feel really rocky sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so wanting to get that and then wanting to have this conversation between these two women about what it means to be alone, right, because I think and it's really great that the music cuts to that song right after because there's this conversation around, like, what the difference between being alone and being lonely, right? And the difference in the ways that I think when we're alone, we're taught we're meant to feel lonely and that's, like, our default. Like, oh, I'm alone, so I have to fill it. And it's like, no, what happens if we're just, like, as Patricia's mom says, like, able to just sit in the aloneness, right? Mm. And we're able to, like, be with ourselves. Like, what then happens? So I just really wanted to kind of get that because I don't think that women of color are allowed that. I don't think we're ever really allowed to just be alone and not attached to someone. We're always the best friend or, like, this person's girlfriend or whatever. And I wanted to create a space in which they could both be together and then realizing that, like, it is okay to be alone, even when they're together, you know. And, like, Patricia's mom also said, she says, like, she's like, you know, I've always had, like, your sisters or your father or whatever. And, like, Patricia's implicated in that, like,
yeah,
because mm-hmm. of Patricia, like, her mom can't always fully, like, be selfish or, like, be yeah. herself. And I think that's, like, a really hard conversation to have with your parents, but an important one too.
Yeah, I mean, especially when, like, you. So many people, I think, especially if you're able to make it to adulthood and your parents were still together, you probably, like, idolize mm-hmm. or you, like, hope that you can have that in yeah. some way. And that seems to be something Patricia's, like, really struggling with.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, wait, like, even if I do find someone, I could, like, 20 years down the line.
Yeah. It could just be gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, obviously, Brown Girls is about millennials. It's set in an urban setting and it's all about trying to navigate careers and relationships and yourself and paying rent. Mm-hmm. So how often do you get compared to girls? And how do you tell people, no, this is different? Because I imagine, like, I feel like every single show now or web series that is about millennials in an urban setting, it's like, girls, but this. And, like, how do you deal with that?
Yes. I mean, Fati's been really good at, she's just, I feel like she's just better at interviews than I am.
That's not true.
But I thought they're doing great.
She had a really good point in an earlier interview that we did where she talked about how, like, she's never seen girls, yeah. Right? So,
that's not a bad thing.
Yeah. None of the writing is at all influenced by that. But she talks about how, like, we're not, like, girls in Broad City, that's not our lineage. Like, our lineage is, like, Awkward Black Girl, it's Atlanta, it's Insecure, it's, like, those, I Can't Solve, it's, like, those shows where, we're really getting to show nuanced characters of color who are like at the forefront of their own storytelling, and I think like that's what I want to navigate the conversation to. It's not girls. There's nothing about girls that I think other than there being young women in it. Which, right. If like we want to go through like every show that there's a young woman in, call it girls, like that's your prerogative. But I don't think that's like what we are trying to do.
Yeah.
And so I think the way that we're now. One is that we say, like, this is our lineage, it's not that. But also just saying, like, not at all. Like, we're not at all influenced yeah. by that. Like, and I think we should open like, the conversation up to what other things can inspire us. Like, I didn't pull anything from girls when we were looking at, like, the visual treatment. Right. But I did for, like, Newly Weeds from, like, Chaka King. Like, I used that a lot as, like,
a
visual influence for the show. And, like, stuff like that. Like, let's talk about that. Because I think that's actually what we're pulling from when we're looking at stuff. We're not looking at girls. Yeah.
And I think, like, to go off that, there's just more interesting, like, there's just more interesting lineages that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Like, we're talking about these shows that are deeply, deeply interesting to us. But we're also talking about, like, hybrid, like, different international shows and, like a broader world scope. Like, you know, like, mm-hmm. we talked about, like, Sam loves this web series called Polyglots, which is really great, right? I think we're and, like, a lot of this stuff came out around the same time as Brown Girls. So, mm-hmm. like, they weren't influential in the writing or anything, but they are very much in the lineage. Like, I was thinking about this Indian web series called Ladies Room, which is...
I've heard of it. I haven't checked it out yet.
It's really funny. And it's just, like, these two girls who are stuck in bathrooms all the time. And, like, they are, like, kind of constantly in these, like, situations that they have to get out of. Like, thinking about that and thinking about even, like, one of Sam and I's early conversations was about, like, I really love Bollywood, right? But what I love about Bollywood is its wide shots, and I love the colors in Bollywood, right? And thinking about how could we make like a Chicago Bollywood, essentially, like how do we frame Chicago that way? Mm-hmm. And I think that those are really rich, complicated ideas, yeah. right? But then when people say like girls, like it's like cool, like. Yeah, not all women are the same, and we're all, like, not all the same. And I know that it's called Brown Girl, so the name link is, like, there and stuff, or it can be read as being there. But
they do that. I mean, they did that for You're So Talented. They yeah. called it Girls, too. And I was like, it's about one black woman. But do you? Like, okay, whatever. Whatever's your entry point. Like, I'll take yeah. it as an entry right. point. If that's how you get into it, mm-hmm. Or that's why you come to it, then cool, that's cool. But then I think what you take out of it is that you know that world is much wider than and the influences are much more diverse than anything I think girls.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely feels like Girls is the Friends of the mid-aughts. Like, because for a while it was like everything was like Friends, but set in an office, or mm-hmm. Friends, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And,
yep.
and now it's just Girls.
And, yeah. yeah. And I've never seen Friends either. So.
I haven't seen that yeah. much of Friends. Yeah. I like, remember when I was a kid watching parts of it, but not really.
Yeah, yeah. I was never really that into it yeah. either.
I don't know their names or anything. Like, people are like, what Friends character are you? I was like, I have no idea.
yeah.
You've never taken the BuzzFeed quiz? You're totally Phoebe. yes. So, obviously, you're not Girls. You're your own show. Mm-hmm. So, like we said earlier, talked about earlier, the show is not, at least the first season, is not about race. Like, it's there. Your culture is there. You are there. You exist. Like, by the mere existence of you, it's there. But, like, this is not a show about race. Mm-hmm. Now that we are in, I hate to say it, but we are in a new age mm-hmm. Where things are getting very scary and, you know, people of color, queerness, all those things are being challenged at the very highest levels of our government. Do you have, if you were to get a second season, I don't know if you have gotten one yet or if you're talking about it, but if you do, you're giving each other looks. So I don't know if that means like maybe you do and you just can't talk about it, which is fine. But if you were to get a second season, would you want to tackle more sort of what it's like to be who you are now in this age?
I mean, I think so much just us making work and putting women of color that look like us like in the center of their own stories, like to me that's revolutionary in and of itself, and it's radical in and of itself, right? And I think it says a lot about the world that we live in that content is even being made right now, right? I mean, Fatih can answer that more in terms of like storytelling wise, but I do think like what's so beautiful about Brown Girls is that they don't have to talk about it. Their existence like shows it, right? Yeah. Like, so a lot of what we talk about is like what do we show and not tell, or what do we tell and not show, like all right. of that stuff. And I think like the Brown Girls existing and being able to have these conversations and being able to have them exist in these safe spaces, and when those spaces become not safe or all that stuff, that to me carries a bigger weight. A little more than maybe just like sitting there and talking about that.
Yeah.
Because I want to see them like, I just want to see them in it more than I want to see them like have a conversation about it. I think that could be another show. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. Like I think that there's ways that we can embed that into the backdrop of things. Like even just thinking about, you know, like thinking about the first season right now, right? Like there's, you know, that there are things going on, like, you know, when Patricia is like wearing the Black Lives Matter pin, right? And then mm-hmm. or then you see, like, we were just talking about this, like the postcard of Fred Hampton in the bathroom with Layla when she's like at this party drunk, right? And mm-hmm. there is like a lot of ways of like embedding like our politics and into that, right? And mm-hmm. and to embed like this is the climate, or this is what's going on, and this is what our characters believe, right? And this is how our characters survive, and how our characters like thrive in this moment, or don't thrive, but like love. And I think that that's something I'm like really interested in, is like figuring out the ways in which that kind of goes in. But also, like, I think, you know, it is a scary time, and it's been a scary time for like many communities of color and for since the dawn of America, right? Yeah. Since like before then.
Yeah. We were always suffering.
But I think and I don't know what this is going to look like for the second season, but particularly for the first, I really wanted to make the show about the joys of being a person of color, and not like a lot of Muslim representation I've seen. It's like very, especially growing up, like I never saw Muslim people, characters, anything that showed desire in the slightest. And to show like, you know, to be like, Layla has desires, like Layla likes to have sex, like that is okay. Yeah. And just to kind of change that. Just to do it very like, just to normalize it and to be like, this is what happens, right? And like, do you all think Muslim people don't have sex? Like what? Or like what are we thinking, right? And and I think that, like those things are really important to just kind of like have them be in the fabric of the show, and because they're in the fabric of the characters' lives, right? Because mm-hmm. like these characters are human, and this is just feels natural to what they do.
Yeah. Well, that leads into my last question, which I ask all of my guests, which is, when is the last time you saw something on TV or in film that you weren't a part of, where you felt represented, where you feel like you saw yourself in some way?
Mm-hmm.
Fatih, why don't you go first and then Sam?
I mean, I think right now I'm kind of on a high of the Oscars and thinking about like Moonlight and like just the way, like just thinking about like Mahershala Ali and like being the first Muslim actor to like win an Oscar, right? And just like I like cried. I was like so overwhelmed. And then when Terrell Alvin McCraney made his speech and was like, you know, this is for like the Black and the Brown, like queer folks and gender queer folks, and like if you don't see yourself in the mirror, like we are here for you and we are fighting for you. And like that I think was just like very, very moving to see that on that kind of level. I think I like, you know, why I like love Ladies Room is because I'm like, oh my God, they're like messy and they're, you know, they're like constantly like having to like fish things out of a toilet, and this feels very real to my life. So thinking about some of that stuff, I think.
Cool. What about you, Sam?
I think I like recently rewatched all of Atlanta, mm-hmm. and I mean, the entire series, I felt like, even though I'm not from Atlanta, my sister lives here now, but, like, it just, like, a lot of depictions of black people that I know. Specifically the last episode, though, when Donald goes back to his like, baby mama's house, and Erykah Badu is playing in the background, and they're just, like, and I'm like, oh, my God. I remember, like, grabbing my friend's, like, leg, and I was like, this is, like, so us. You know, like, just to get the music playing, just the complicated relationship, the black people, like, all of that. Like, I know these people so well. And, it also, like, I think, like, moved me to tears. Mm-hmm. I was like, man, even, like, all of it is just so real and so tangible. And I was like, man, if this is where TV is going, like, this is really exciting to me. Mm-hmm. So specifically that moment, though, I love that entire series. Yeah.
Awesome. Good choices. And we'll definitely, I'm going to check out Ladies Room because that sounds really fun.
Yeah.
And we'll link to that in the show notes. Yeah. Thank you so much, ladies, for joining.
Thank you for having us.
This is great.
Yeah. It was very exciting. I can't wait to see what you do next. And yeah, thanks.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you.
All right, that's a wrap. Thank you, Dylan, for your valid critique of Will and Grace. And Fatima and Sam, it was a pleasure to chat with you. Listeners, you should definitely go check out Brown Girls and let us know what you think about it on our Facebook page, Slate Represent. And of course, you can subscribe to us and rate us on iTunes, as well as Megaphone, Stitcher, or any other place you find your podcast if you haven't already. Represent is produced by the lovely, awesome Marilyn Williams. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. Andy Bowers is chief content officer of Panoply. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Slate Represent. That music you're hearing is performed by the sweet San Francisco funk soul band Midtown Social, who just released their new self-titled album, which we'll link to on our show page. It's really good. Until next time.